Hello, everyone, and welcome to Teen Scientist. I'm your host, Raina Malhotra, and doing our audio engineering is James Zipro. Here on Teen Scientist, I aim to bring you stories of groundbreaking innovation in the STEM disciplines entirely from a youth perspective. We feature young researchers and respected experts in their fields at the local, national, and international levels. Tonight, we have the privilege of speaking with our very special guest, Elizabeth Jaja Lee, who's actually a friend of mine that I met from international science fairs, and I actually just saw her this past weekend for another scholarship event, so I'm really excited to speak with her. Welcome, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm doing great, Raina. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. That's amazing to hear, and thank you so much for joining us on Teen Scientist today. Now, before we get started, do you mind just briefly telling us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, of course. So, hi, my name is Elizabeth, and thank you so much for that introduction, Raina. It was so awesome seeing you at the Scholarship Pro Weekend. And yeah, so I'm 18 years old. I'm in 12th grade, so I'm a senior in high school from Thunder Mountain High School in Juneau, Alaska. So I've lived in Juneau my whole life and really get into STEM more later. But yeah, this has been a big part of my upbringing, and go Alaska.
So we're recording this all the way East Coast in Pennsylvania. What's the time there in Alaska right now?
Right, it's 1:07 p.m. here.
So are you missing school for this?
I am not, actually. Senior year, I don't have a fifth or sixth period, so timing was perfect.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, I was going to say, if you were, then that's true dedication, but I'm glad you're not missing any school for this. More personally and about your interests, do you have any defining interests or hobbies that you've had throughout your high school career?
Yeah, for sure. So in school, I think of my STEM activities in terms of probably like a triad. So I do three main STEM activities, I guess from smallest to largest. I'm president of the Enigma Math and Critical Thinking Club in my school. So that's a math club that I founded in freshman year, because before that, Juno didn't have a math club, which is kind of hard to imagine. My teacher and I started the American Mathematics competitions in town. So that's something I've loved working on these past 4 years. I also do a podcast. So thanks, this is super exciting being here, because we have a local podcast called The Future Women of STEM. And we basically interview women in STEM in the community and learn about their stories, share that with the radio and the world. And finally, I'm also with the Alaska Science and Engineering Fair, which is my statewide nonprofit science fair organization. And that's had a huge impact on me. I know we'll cover that later, but I basically run the student board for that and work on fundraising and outreach.
That's awesome that you lead your own podcaster too. I think that you're the very first other podcaster that I've interviewed, so it'll be interesting to see our dynamic.
Oh, really? Yeah, that'd be awesome. We have to have you on the show sometime.
Yeah, maybe. We'll reverse the roles.
Yes.
Have you always been interested in science, or was it a field that you kind of gradually became more interested in as you got older?
I think that I really started in math. So I was the M in STEM for probably the longest time. In middle school, I did math counts. And then in high school, I moved towards science fair after doing like my first science project on macroalgae bioplastic. And that's the one that I took to International Science Fair my sophomore year. And I have to really credit International Science Fair, like ISEF, where I met Raina, and for giving me that interest in STEM and science to begin with.
So you mentioned that first project. Can you share how your interest in science and research initially sparked, if there was like a particular moment or experience that kind of ignited that for you?
Right. I think it was probably the moment that I almost tasted my seaweed bioplastic cup. So like I said, my first project was very basic. It was basically making seaweed bioplastic. I highly recommend it as a starting project for any like middle schooler, maybe an elementary schooler to do. But basically I harvested some seaweed from the shores in town, realized that was way too bulky to actually mince up. So I ended up buying some seaweed powder from online and making that into some seaweed paste that hardened into basically these bioplastic cups. So that was going to be biodegradable. I was super excited about it. And probably the moment that I realized, okay, I can actually eat my science project, was the moment I was like, okay, I like science.
So would you say, because I think that's like a very niche project to start with, would you say that your environment has like influenced a lot of the decisions you've made, whether it's creatively or also in the world of STEM? Like, do you think being in Alaska, being in Juneau has influenced the decisions you've made along the way?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I've lived in Juneau my whole life. I was probably born like in the hospital just a few miles from my house right now. It's a small town environment. And I actually wrote about this in one of my essays for college or something, but it's kind of like a tide pool, this place, in all the best ways, right? So you really like learn how to take advantage of every resource that's here, and also learn to find interesting things in the natural world around you, because there's not a ton to do like urban wise compared to a city. But over here, you can go hiking, you can go on the shores in town, the beaches, and just learning about everything that's around you, especially the living things. So that's how I got into my life sciences interest, my environmental science interest. And that's had a huge impact on my passion for environmental science. And also like for my project that was after the bioplastic cups was about salmon. So that's something that's really important to my Alaska community in town and over the state. So that's how I got into that.
That's awesome. It's great to hear that you're like really taking advantage of the environment that you're surrounded in, especially since it's like so specific and so unique. You mentioned those resources. I kind of want to touch on those specifically in the context of your elementary and middle school education. What kind of resources did you have access to at a younger age that you think you were able to use to grow your interest in the sciences, whether that's like camps or online programs? Is there anything that really stuck out to you that you think kind of gave you a leg up in this process going into high school?
Yeah, definitely. I'd say like being from a small town, I really took advantage of just the internet. It might sound basic, but going online and just looking at, I mean, the whole International Science Fair virtual exhibits, all 1600 plus projects is online at your fingertips. And all these students are just putting their projects out there open source. So you can learn about 1600 different projects in I think 20 or so categories. So looking through those really helped me narrow down, okay, which fields am I super interested in to begin with? And then I actually did buy this book called A Plus Science Fair Projects, not a plug, but basically that was a really good book just because it took me through the basic processes of even doing a science project. And I'd say finally, the people in town have been really, really helpful and kind. It's just that's the benefits of like this small town, is that everyone was so willing to help. Even when I was just cold emailing a local scientist, like no one ever said no. So my mentor for my later science project and my current one ended up just being someone from the local National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And he was perfectly happy to just respond to a student's email. So for the middle schoolers and elementary schoolers out there, I highly recommend the internet, old-fashioned books, and the good cold email, and just reaching out to your teachers and mentors in town.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would recommend the same thing. I think a lot of it is just like seeking those opportunities because they're not going to fall in your lap. So just going out of your way to find knowledge and curiosity in different places that you wouldn't even expect. I completely agree with that. Now, before we even dive into your most recent kind of most robust research project, could you give us a little bit of an overview of the other science or research experiences that you've had prior to this major project?
Right. So I think I'll start with my first science project again. So that was bioplastic seaweed cups. That started from my interest in environmental science. So looking around in Juneau, literally this whole place is probably ground zero for environmental science, climate change, and pollution control. So I identified that as a problem that I cared a lot about that affected my community. So then I started looking for solutions for that. And that's how I got into bioplastic seaweed cups. But then after that, I would have to say, I really enjoyed my field expedition onto Gulkana Glacier, which is just south of Fairbanks, Alaska. And that involved a science project component. So my friends and I, which became like a small research team, we just studied glacial albedo, which is basically how the reflective surfaces of the glacier will reflect light back into space. And that can actually help alleviate climate change. So we were just analyzing how the disappearance of glaciers and the disappearance of these bright surfaces is contributing to climate change, because now there's less reflective surfaces to send that heat back into space. So I really enjoyed that. And I think there's something that's common among all these projects I enjoyed, is I really just enjoy going to the field. So I guess I said internet and books earlier, but I would mention also just getting out into the environment around you, whether that's a local hike or a road or the beach, and just seeing all those signs all around you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's so inspiring to hear how you're so hands-on with your environment. I love to hear those kinds of stories. Were there any challenges that you faced while transitioning from being interested in science to actively engaging in research? Like, I think a lot of middle schoolers, especially going from like an interest in STEM in the classroom to an interest in STEM like in the real world, kind of struggle with that transition. So I kind of wanted to hear about what was your experience like with that?
Yeah, so I'd say the biggest challenge is probably just getting started. And that's a very common thread among anything, like whether you're starting a club or starting a podcast or doing what you're doing, like hosting this amazing show, is just getting started on such a opportunity. So for me, getting started in science fair. So I got interested, when my friend did science fair before me, and then she qualified for International Science Fair when it was a virtual one still back in 2020. So then I was thinking, okay, how do I do a science project? Because this seems super cool. So I just started Googling all sorts of random stuff, basically, like past science projects, questions that I was interested in. So I think back then I was really interested in just nanotech. partly because I just maybe watched it in a Marvel movie, realized, okay, maybe there's not a nanotech lab in Juneau, Alaska. So then I pivoted to a different project. But I think just being very curious about what you're interested in and reading a lot about STEM. So the MIT Technology Review is one of my all-time favorite things to read, and they have free articles that you can read from there in certain places. Finding those free resources, and I guess, like, since we do International Science Fair, we'll put in a plug for Science News, which is from Society for Science, and that's they have free subscriptions for your school if you sign up. So just like looking at those publications and being curious.
And then for your project, the one that we're just about to touch on, did you work in a lab for that? Because I think you mentioned like cold emailing and things like that. Was that something that you had a strict kind of professional mentor working with you, or was that kind of something that you worked on independently in your own kind of workspace?
That was a big jump from my macroalgae bioplastic cups project because this time I actually was more in a lab setting. So because I didn't have the certifications, I guess I couldn't touch the lab equipment as much as I would have liked to, but I've got to go through and shadow the process and basically learn the whole process from start to finish and be there while they were doing the actual metabarcoding, which we'll cover later. And then I got to go field sampling sometimes to go out into the field and actually collect the eDNA samples. Mainly, it was maybe a combination of both to answer that question. So I got to go through the lab, go into the field, but also my main component was also in data analysis. So that part I could just do mostly independently at home from my laptop.
How did you land your position in that lab?
That one actually was nice because it didn't have the cold email. So one of my best friends at school, and that's, I guess, another small town moment, but one of my best friends in school that I've known since freshman year, I learned in junior year, I think, that his dad is actually the head of the local National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So that's NOAA. So I got to just have a phone call with his dad and learn about these cutting edge technologies that were going on there. And at the time, it was environmental DNA, macroalgae, how to increase macroalgae, or so aquaculture and things like that. And out of all those topics, I was like, okay, environmental DNA, that sounds super fascinating. How do I get into that more? So then Dr. Foy basically pointed me to Dr. Larson, who became my actual mentor, and he's the head of the genetics department. And we got to go through a meeting, and he decided to take me on as a mentee. And that was a very pivotal moment because he actually later wrote in a letter for colleges that he said that he was still deciding in that 10 minutes whether he could take on a high school mentee. And I thank goodness he did because that has been such a transformative part of my high school career.
Yeah, that's really amazing. And honestly, again, kudos to you for like having that courage to like use those connections and take advantage of that. That's, I think, from what I've seen, really common in the world of science. Like a lot of people are using who they know because a lot of it's just like random. Even if you don't get responses from those cold emails, like using those connections can always be a great way to land those positions. Now, I do want to transition to speak a little bit about the actual work that you've done. We've danced around it for a little bit, but now we actually want to get into the actual meat of it. So, diving right in, can you briefly explain what exactly your most recent major research project was about?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So my most recent research project, I can say the long title is like quantitative environmental DNA metabarcoding for the enumeration of Pacific salmon. And if that sounds like a bunch of gibberish, the simple form is that we use environmental DNA to detect and quantify, basically count salmon. This is super important because salmon is just so important to Alaska. And yet, in order to conserve and properly manage salmon species so they can continue to be here for generations, we need to be able to detect them and then count them. And traditional methods of that are just very costly. They're expensive, they're time consuming, and you need an expert. So you need to know what fish you're actually looking at. So my project is about using a different method that's cheaper, less invasive. It doesn't need expertise and less time consuming, and that's environmental DNA, which I'm going to call eDNA from now on. So eDNA is basically any source of cell an organism sheds in its habitat. That's like skin cells, urine, feces, mucus, all that good stuff. And you can collect this and go through a process called metabarcoding that essentially sequences the DNA from the DNA samples. So you literally get a whole sheet of A, C, T, G, all that good combination. And you can match this to the species that it's from. And based on how many times you see that read, you can about know the quantity of the species. So that was my project.
Well, that sounds really, really amazing. And I hate to cut you off, but we do need to pause for a quick break. But when we return, we'll jump right back into everything we just started discussing, and we'll have Elizabeth start sharing her advice for other aspiring scientists. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on Teen Scientist.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100 or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to Teen Scientist on WDIY. I'm your host, Raina Malhotra, and tonight's guest is Elizabeth Jaja Lee, joining us all the way from Juneau, Alaska. We just finished discussing her background and early experiences with science, and now we're going to dive right back in and continue discussing her award-winning research project. Now, Elizabeth, can you elaborate on the specific methods that you use to collect eDNA samples in your study?
Yeah, so basically, to overview my project again, basically we were using environmental DNA, or also known as eDNA, to quantify sockeye salmon. And you can do this by sampling from the creek, going through metabarcoding, and then getting a reed count, and ultimately getting the fish count from that for six species. So what we did for the process was I did a study on six different species of fish. So that included the five Pacific salmon species plus rainbow trout. And all of these are very prevalent in the Bristol Bay watershed of Southwest Alaska. And that's where we took our samples. So we worked with a team and we sampled from about the middle of the creeks, about 10 centimeters below the surface, all those details. But basically, we attained like 1 liter water sample. So if you think about the hydro flask you bring to school, about that big. And we took the samples from eight creeks around this Wood River watershed and basically preserved them, brought them back to the lab in Juneau, and then did the metabarcoding here. So as for metabarcoding in the lab, that involved DNA extraction. Then we had PCR, which basically made more copies of the DNA from what we had. And then we added that into a MyFish machine, which is the one that actually sequences the DNA from the DNA extracted samples. So all that produced this really cool, super long spreadsheet that had these huge reads of just ACs, T's, and G's in all sorts of combinations. And you can basically copy paste them into this database from the National Centers for Biotechnology Institutes that's going to match the reads to what species they're from. And from that, we basically counted, okay, how many times does the sockeye salmon sequence occur? And that's going to tell you about the abundance of sockeye salmon in the watershed.
And then can you go through the process of exactly how you counted fish from eDNA and then how you kind of extracted and analyzed that? And then also maybe some challenges that you encountered along the way during the eDNA metabarcoding?
Right. So I think counting fish from eDNA is inherently a little bit challenging just because it's not a raw count. So for example, the gold standard, so how you usually count fish is one method is called visual counting. So you basically walk along the entire creek and visually count how many fish there are. And you have a clicker in your hand and you count, okay, this is about a group of 1,000 or 10,000 fish here. And then you go through the whole river, it takes about a whole day, and you count visually. But once you do that, you're done. So you have the visual raw number of the fish. But for environmental DNA, the challenge there is that it's a concentration count. So that means that the size of the creek actually matters. So imagine like you have a small bucket and then a large bucket, and each bucket has three fish. But the large bucket is going to give you a lower signal than the small bucket just because the eDNA that's in the water is less concentrated. So when we quantified the abundance of fish from eDNA, it's still not a perfect abundance estimate, but we essentially did a linear regression so we can match up the abundance of eDNA in the water to the visual count that we also did. So the visual count was our gold standard that we compared it to. And the hope is that eventually there'll be enough studies on eDNA that you have so much data, have a good enough fit that you can just take the eDNA count and then just match that to a visual count without having to take a whole day to walk across the stream.
Before doing this, have you ever tried that before, that method where you have to walk around with a clicker, or no?
I actually have not, because that's one of the great things about eDNA is that even lay people like me, so I'm a high schooler, right? I'm a citizen scientist, I guess, in this case, in some ways, because I can just like help sample the eDNA and I can already like, you know, be part of that process, even though I don't like have the expertise to visually count the fish. So that was credit to University of Washington's Alaska Salmon Program is where we got the visual counts from.
Awesome. I was just curious, like how many people have actually done that where they're walking around and counting with their own eyes. But can you discuss the criteria that you use to actually select the eight creeks in the Wood River watershed as sampling sites?
Yeah, so that was actually a really exciting point of my project, I think, is because the Wood River watershed is connected to Bristol Bay. So that's in southwest Alaska, if you think along where the Aleutian Islands begins. So that part is actually the largest sockeye salmon fishery in the world. I mean, Alaska, you think salmon, you think seafood, but that is literally the largest fishery in the world. So a huge amount of sockeye salmon return there to spawn every year. So that's a big part of why I was selected for this project.
And then, how did you ensure the accuracy and reliability of the visual survey counts that you used as the reference data for comparison?
Yeah, that was a lot of credit to University of Washington's Alaska Salmon Program. It's a really established program, and it's also they have undergraduates who are actually studying like at the undergrad level of environmental science who are doing all these counting. So that was a very trusted source that we are very grateful to have.
Definitely. And then I feel like this is kind of an interesting question, but were there any unexpected findings or discrepancies between the visual survey counts and eDNA counts that you faced during the study?
Oh, definitely. So one of the interesting things was the discrepancy between live versus dead fish. So obviously, when you're visually counting a creek, you can visually see whether a salmon is floating there as a carcass or is swimming around and is alive. But when you're sampling eDNA, it's all the same because actually you'd expect the dead decomposing salmon bodies to release more DNA than the living fish. So that was one thing in our project. We had this one creek that had a huge spike in these two species of fish that were very low in the visual counts. So we're thinking, why is there so much eDNA for these fish when there's barely any visual counts? And that was because of an upstream fishing lodge that was probably discarding the dead fish innards, as the Alaskans were like gutting the fish and discarding the innards into the creek. That's something that was probably causing the eDNA spike. So that just brings up an important point that when you're using eDNA to quantify species, you have to be able to note that it's counting both live and dead species.
Can you just discuss like the actual results that you found in terms of like the relationship between visual survey count and eDNA count for sockeye salmon, and then also what factors that you think kind of contributed to those observations?
So the overarching question to begin with was, can eDNA metabarcoding accurately quantify salmon? And what we found was that essentially, yes, it can, because we saw that there was a significant positive, strong, moderately strong relationship between eDNA and the visual count. And what this is telling us is basically, yeah, eDNA does pretty much match up with our visual counts. So that also makes a lot of intuitive sense because as you have more fish in the creek, they're going to be shedding a ton more DNA and you're going to have a higher eDNA signal from this fish.
Looking more large scale, how might the results of this study influence the future application of eDNA metabarcoding in fisheries management and conservation efforts?
Right, so I think that's another cool part about this project, and a big part of why I wanted to study environmental DNA to begin with is because it's both a very local and global topic. And by that, I mean, like, yes, salmon was the subject of this study because it's a model organism, so it has huge implications for being implemented in fisheries management and conservation on that front. But also, it's not just limited to salmon. So eDNA can come from anything that has DNA, basically. So that's think microorganisms, microscopic algae that you can't even see with your eye. Or I read this one paper in my research process where they sampled eDNA from the air. So instead of water, it's from the air in different parts of a hospital and used that to tell which pathogens were spreading around which parts of the hospital. And basically, and especially in nowadays day and age, we're in the middle of what some people call the sixth mass extinction. So we're losing species at drastic rates right now. So it's really important, like now more than ever, to have these new methods of quickly and cheaply quantifying species so we can better conserve the species we coexist with.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting to actually hear those applications across the board, both like outside the environment that your study is taking place in, and even in the sphere of like hospitals or like extinctions and stuff. Can you speak a little bit more about the potential limitations of using eDNA metabarcoding for quantifying fish species, or in general, cases where it might not work as expected?
At least for my study, again, because we did the study in Alaska where, you know, water temperatures are typically lower. So I think the main thing that's a limitation for eDNA right now is just that it's so new. So this technology is only about 2 decades old. I think the first study was in 1999 or something. And basically, what we need right now is just more people to be researching this and really defining the parameters of eDNA's use. Because, like I said, it's a concentration measure right now. You can't translate it into a raw count. So as of right now, it cannot replace traditional traditional methods. It can only supplement them, I think. So what you really need is just more research to be done in this area and to be done in different places around the world. Because if you want to apply eDNA to more species, there should be studies around maybe the equator where the water temperatures are higher, because naturally DNA will degrade faster in warmer temperatures. So you want to see how long the DNA will last there. So I think eDNA technology just needs a lot more research in that front to really define how it can be used.
Looking kind of in the future for you, are there any follow-up studies or areas of research that you believe should be explored based on your findings?
Yeah, so right now I'm actually working on a continuation project that I'm going to take to this year's International Science Fair in Los Angeles. Super excited for that. So last year's project was on metabarcoding. So that's one method to turn the eDNA into account. But this year I'm working with a different method called quantitative polymerase chain reaction, also known as qPCR. And this is essentially a more single species, but a potentially more accurate method of translating the eDNA to account in the lab. So like this is one of those follow-up studies that I think we should needs to have more of, which is where you're comparing different methods of analyzing the DNA so you can define which one's better and for what purposes. So like for right now, my study this time found that, okay, qPCR and metabarcoding were actually pretty comparable, at least in my study, but qPCR is typically better for single species. So they can only do about 1 to 4 species at a time, where metabarcoding, you know, hence the prefix meta, is a more holistic whole ecosystem approach.
Yeah, definitely. And you just mentioned ICEF, the International Fair, again, and I think we've brought it up a couple times, so I kind of want to touch on it. You qualified again this year, and you also won Grand Award last year, so congratulations on both of those. That's amazing. But I do want to ask, what even inspired you to submit your work to these fairs, and did you even expect to walk out with a Grand Award last year?
Oh, I definitely did not expect to walk out with a Grand Award, especially if you told my sophomore year self that I would be on the International Science Fair stage at all. That would just be insane to me, because I started doing science fair relatively late, because I started sophomore year of high school. And I was inspired by one of my friends who was my teammate for a project that we did, I guess a mini project that we sort of didn't end up submitting before the macroalgae bioplastic. But basically, she did a research project on, I think it was renewable energy in town when I was a freshman. So I looked at that project, I'm like, oh, that's so cool. I'm into renewable energy, because like we basically analyzed electric vehicles in Juneau. And I thought, okay, how can I do a science project? And what's this international fair all about? Everything you get to do there, just the sheer number of projects that were present there and people from all over the world was just insane to me, especially being a small town girl. You know, I'm like, I was born and raised here. So every time I get to go out and meet people from all 50 states and all over the world, about like 60 countries at ICEF, is just absolutely mind-blowing to me. And I was very excited to like actually get to go. So I gotta be honest, my goal sophomore year was literally just to qualify for the international fair. Never did I expect that the next year I would actually be able to go there and walk on the ICEF stage.
Yeah, and honestly, I couldn't agree more. I think the environment there is like so electric. So congratulations again for qualifying this year. I'm sure you're gonna do amazing. Now, one of the major things that's kind of involved in this whole like science fair research process is the actual communication of your work. And as we've heard today, you've done an amazing job of articulating a lot of complicated topics, but I'm sure it probably didn't always start out like that. So I kind of wanted to get your kind of 2 cents on what kind of strategies have you used along the way to ensure that you're actually communicating your findings effectively to both scientific communities and general audiences.
Right. So I think there's 2 parts to that, at least for me. The first one is empathy. The second one is probably just like authenticity, I guess. I mean, our guest speaker at the scholarship event we were just at, we talked a lot about authenticity. So I liked that a lot. But to start with empathy, so my mom was like, I guess, my first tutor. So when I was in elementary school, she would just sit down with me, teach me Mandarin and math concepts. What really struck me about her teaching that was so effective for me is that she really paid attention to whether I was actually getting what she was saying. So especially for kids, I think it's so easy for them to just nod their heads and be going along, but actually be zoning out. So for me, whenever I teach someone one-on-one or teach an audience that like a kid that comes to my science project booth, a topic, I just have to be really empathetic and be paying attention, not just to how I'm talking, but also to whether they're actually like understanding. And when they have that like glow up effect where they're like, oh, I really get that, that's so rewarding and gratifying for me. So that would be my first point. And then my second point was just authenticity. So that's about how I designed the poster board, and I really like graphic design. It's one of my hobbies. So I really like using Adobe Illustrator and a little bit of Photoshop and some of the other Adobe Fresco suites. Super fun. So basically, my board was probably a little bit unconventional just because I didn't have a solid background color. I had a big picture of a salmon fish in my background, and I had this like salmon picture on my poster board, and I had these big words that said EDNA conserved salmon that is kind of an unconventional design at the International Science Fair. But I really wanted to do that because I think that just having that authentic communication through more visual imagery and making things not only understandable and interesting, but also very aesthetic and rewarding to learn was part of how I communicated my research.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, on that topic of authenticity, I feel like we can smoothly transition to talk about what you do outside of the STEM sphere. What do you do for fun in terms of whether that's athletics or arts? Where can we find Elizabeth outside of the lab?
Yes, so outside of lab, so many hobbies. So I really love playing tennis. So I'm on the tennis team, and we just went to state last semester. So that was one of the most fun trips I've ever been on, probably second to ISEF, just because you have such a good community in the tennis team. And you also get to walk around, like get some exercise in addition to like exercising your brain and research. But then also I love the arts. So I mentioned graphic design. So I do a lot of that. I design like the logos for my in math club, and for the t-shirts for that, and for the Future Women of STEM podcast. Basically, like design something for everything I'm part of. Outside of that, also a lot of music. So I played the violin for 14 years now, and I just really enjoy being part of my orchestra community and that niche in my town. My biggest hobby is probably just spontaneously bursting into song. I just do that all the time throughout the day. It's something I just enjoy, and I just actually wrote my first original song about a month ago. So that's going to, I'm still refining that, but hopefully that will drop somewhere.
Wow, that is so impressive. I honestly cannot speak to singing at all. Like, that is totally not in my toolbox, but I applaud you for how much you've got going on. What advice would you give to other high school students who may be also balancing academics and extracurricular activities and so much other stuff like you are doing?
Yeah, my biggest advice, especially for high schoolers, and this is some advice that I learned from just watching YouTube videos when I was a freshman, is to just only do stuff that you really, really love. And that's going to be so impactful and so important as you go through high school and college to avoid, not only avoid burnout, but actually just get more energy from the stuff that you do. So because if you really like believe in the things you do, whether just you enjoy doing it or you believe in the impact of what it's doing. So like, for example, my research was something I was very passionate about because I know it has an impact on literally this environment that supported me my whole life. So that's something that would really motivated me to keep doing that. And then other things that I just enjoy intrinsically doing, even if it doesn't necessarily produce anything, like for example, just like singing or violin or stuff like that, that I just really enjoy doing those things and have making music with friends or hitting a fuzzy green ball around the court. So it's productive at the same time, but it's also just very energizing. And that's going to keep you going for a lot of what you do.
There's a quote where it's like, if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life. That's basically how it is with, I feel like, academics and research. If you kind of commit to the things that you actually enjoy, then you'll never feel like that burden or burnout. So I totally agree. Now, you're a senior about to graduate from high school, just like me. So first of all, I'm curious, and I'm sure our listeners are too, where are you going to school and what are your kind of future goals long term and your aspirations?
I recently committed to Harvard University. So excited, so thrilled to be going to be spending the next 4 years there. And congrats, Raina, on Stanford. Yeah, so I'm going to be pursuing environmental science and public policy is the major that I applied as. But again, I'm open to exploring other majors when I'm there.
Awesome. And I love Boston, so I'm sure you'll really, really enjoy it. Honestly, I wish you picked Stanford because that would be the move. Then we could be together. But
Definitely, yeah.
congratulations either way. Now, lastly, where can our listeners go to learn more about you and your research?
Yeah, so you can find me if you find me on Instagram. I post about International Science Fair on there. So at elizabeth.jajali. So I'm on there. Do a Google search. Maybe you can find me on LinkedIn. I'll try to update my LinkedIn more. Honestly, in Alaska, we don't use that as much. Definitely, high schoolers in Alaska are not LinkedIn people. So that's something that I'll definitely be adding more to. And also, I'm hoping to post a big list of scholarship opportunities and all these research project opportunities that I think juniors and younger should really know about. And I'll be posting that on my Instagram. probably on my LinkedIn. And if you're interested in hearing any violin or singing videos, you can check out my YouTube channel at Elizabeth Jajali also.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Elizabeth. We really appreciate you sharing your research and experiences with us. It's super inspiring to see other high school students make such massive impacts on the world. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to Teen Scientist tonight. I'm Raina Malhotra, and I'll see you next time.
If you enjoyed this program, please go to WDIY.org or the WDIY app to share or become a WDIY member.